Well, there are both advantages and disadvantages to being the last person. The disadvantages is you hear a number of common themes over and over and over again, so what you end up saying, you're not going to get the aha response. However, you also have the advantage of being able to pull it all together. And I feel that with what I will be talking about today, this is really an opportunity to kind of pull you out of focusing on the Bronx as this is unique to the Bronx, into putting it into a broader perspective of these are issues that are present when you are dealing with vulnerable populations that are underserved, that are experiencing social disparities, and these are illustrative ways in the various discussions that were going on in which these social disparities are impacting health status. And the other thing that has been coming out, and the reason why I'm saying this is because I'll be going through the same types of things, is showing how it's a similar model across a variety of different types of disease issues. What I'm going to be talking about today is the other part of the care package. You've heard about the providers and the continuity of care and linkages and lack of linkages and the clinician's viewpoint of being able to engage people and get them involved. But there's another very important element attached to that, and that's the family or the informal support system. So this particular presentation is going to talk about the mental health consequences to the family members who are engaged in providing care and support and assistance to medically underserved, vulnerable, resource-constrained individuals who are living in the community. And coincidentally, or maybe session planners, this population is the Bronx population. New York has one very bad borough, apparently. The Bronx happens to be the highest prevalence of HIV/AIDS in the New York metropolitan area. So it is really a model for being able to kind of go in and look at social problems and how social problems impact communities' health. Again, no significant relationships to disclose. This was funded by a grant from the National Institute of Nursing Research. The overall focus of the grant was care preferences and life priorities of persons with AIDS who are approaching death. The overall study rationale really came out of clinical practice from when we were working with several demonstration programs throughout the nation who were funded to deliver palliative care to medically underserved and hard-to-reach populations. And one of the things that happened as part of that was the idea of palliative care is it is person-centered care, it's respecting the wishes of the individual as they are approaching dying, whether they want intensive treatment, whether they want non-intensive treatment. And this was an instance in which someone really wanted the traditional palliative model, did not want to be put on a respirator at the end of life, but as they approached the end of life, they changed their mind. And they wanted to be hospitalized, put on a respirator, and the family was very upset because they thought that the clinicians ignored the wishes of the patient because they were all on board with this non-invasive, non-intensive care. And it required communication between the patient, the family, and the clinicians to have it all resolved that, no, they were, in fact, respecting the current wishes of the patient. So what this came home is that even in the best of models, when you have three individuals, three different types of groups involved in care, not everybody is always going to be on the same page at all times. And you need to respect the respective perspectives and wishes in terms of moving forward. And so that's the rationale for that particular study is as people are approaching the end of life, what is the consistency of their care preferences, their life priorities, how does that impact that? Are both the informal caregivers and the care recipients, the dying patient, on the same page? And how do the clinicians get into the mix? So overall, Palliative care is still an important source of care to individuals who have HIV/AIDS, because even though for many individuals HIV is now turned into a chronic disease as opposed to acute disease, there are subpopulations in which that is not the case. And for those individuals, one needs to kind of go back to the original palliative care model that was in play when AIDS was first on the scene as a devastating, quickly fatal disease. Palliative care is a mode of care in which family members and significant others are involved in providing some very essential care and support. With a disease such as HIV, which is very complex, they also are engaged in this level of care from a very early point on in the disease course. So they've weathered this whole disease trajectory. This represents the trajectory of dying in advanced AIDS in the U.S. What you are seeing is, of course, there is a decline to death, but all the little arrows, the little sharp drops, are all the multitude of crises that happen with HIV/AIDS. It is, of course, opportunistic infection. So basically that means when an infection hits, that person could immediately die. And that's what that drop in functioning is. If the medical treatment is successful at that particular point, they may be able to rally, and they stabilize, and they go back up to that prior level of functioning. So what you end up having is you don't have a planned slow decline to death. You always have hope. You always have despair. You always have a sense of anxiety and worry. And the time has continued to now expand longer and longer. This used to be the pattern when we first had AIDS. It was a rapid decline. It wasn't all these series of small little things because there was no treatment. As we keep getting more and more treatment, these crises get more frequent because it more and more things happen. So what that ends up being then is you need to think in terms of it from the family caregiver's perspective. They've been engaged in this whole process with the patient. Community issues impact HIV palliative care. I don't really need to go into a lot because it really does cover. It impacts in a under-resourced community with a high level of need. HIV/AIDS, regardless of where you are in the country, not just in the Bronx, it happens in impoverished communities. Characteristics of impoverished communities are AIDS services are fragmented. There's a scarcity of expert and accessible palliative care services in these communities. And there's also limited ancillary services and links to agency resources. So all the things that we need for transitional care management and maximizing the level of care is just not there. AIDS and HIV has some additional things that make it a little bit more complex than other types of acute or chronic diseases. It's still stigmatized. There's still a fear of contagion in many communities. I've talked about the episodic nature of it, the unpredictable disease trajectory. It's difficult to determine exactly when to initiate what one regards as palliative care, the idea of not engaging in active treatment. There's multiple medical problems. People who have HIV have a lot of other comorbid conditions, and palliating one symptom may require treating a different symptom. So like they may be terminally ill with one condition, but another condition that they may have at the same time may be treatable, and that may be able to prolong their life. So you're balancing, and it's a mix of palliative and curative treatments going on at once, never with the idea that this person will ever be completely well, but really kind of maintaining their health status and quality of life as much as possible. As they progress closer to death, opportunistic infections and multiple disease complications increase and intensify as one advances towards the advanced stages. And so that many of the comorbid conditions are arising out of their behavior and life circumstances. We're dealing with individuals who are homeless, drug abusers, violent, multiple mentally diagnosed, a lifetime of impoverishment. So they are, and you know, lack of medical care. All of those things together make for complicated care. What is interesting is for many of the individuals who, when diagnosed with HIV and ended up needing to start having palliative care, they actually enjoyed being in a palliative care program because for the first time in their lives they had integrated care and supportive services. So it was a devastating disease that hooked them into the social service system that they didn't have. The disease course and treatment advances is known throughout the community of people who have HIV, even though it may not directly apply to them and their condition, so that they are very optimistic in many cases about a sense of prolonged belief. Having lived through many multiple health crises, they tend to feel, well, this is just one more crisis that I will be able to weather. So when we are needing to deal with these conditions of adjusting to dying, we're doing that with expectations that may not necessarily be realistic. And some of them are because of prior experiences that they've had. It's important to understand that these expectations are shared not just by the patient, but by the family or informal care provider who has been with them throughout the whole disease course. So it's shared expectations. We interviewed 95 dyads with advanced AIDS and their family caregivers. They completed in-depth interviews and brief questionnaires. The interviews were conducted by health clinicians. Again, the demographics. Adults who are dying with HIV are across the age range. It was about half Hispanic, half black are populations who were able to get a good racial ethnic mix, equal men and women. Low education, while a number of them were never married, the majority of them were in a significant relationship, and the bulk of them did have children. The caregivers were slightly younger, had children. More of them were female, as one would expect. In terms of the caregiver demographics, they were not many of them were as married as the patient was, and that was because of the fact that in many instances they were the adult child of the individual who had HIV/AIDS, and they just hadn't gotten into that stage of adult development. A few were parents. A number of them were the spouse partners who themselves were HIV positive. About one-fifth were family members. And the other relatives included siblings and aunts and uncles. So one of the big things that happen as one approaches the end of life is, who do you turn to for treatment decision making? The whole concept of advanced directives means you may have a decision plan, but you also have someone who is your designate who will be able to advise on treatment and care and, in a sense, when to pull the plug. So the caregiver is faced with a challenge, their sense of ambivalence. They have a responsibility to respect the wishes of the person who is dying if they accept that role, but at the same time, that may not be a choice that either they would be comfortable making for themselves or that they necessarily want the individual to have. So this person is explaining how we reacted to being informed by the patient as to what he wanted to have done. He said, 3 days and then you let me go. And I said, oh boy, I said, how could you? I said, oh, I don't know. I don't know if I could do that. You know, because that would be hard for me. Maybe I could do it, but it would be really hard. So in other words, the patient's saying, if it's looking hopeless after 3 days, just pull the plug. That means I've had it. And the person's saying, I'll try. I don't know if I could really do it, but I'll try. So it's not even saying I'm not going to do it or I disagree. They don't know if in themselves they have the ability to be able to take this life and death responsibility and be the one that says, okay, you're out. We're not going to try to weather any more crises. Accepting, understanding care choices. He once said he wouldn't want to be on the machine that long. if it wasn't going to make him better. One of the things you talk about with advanced directives are, would you want this treatment if the likelihood of you getting better is slight? And the quality of life while you are on that treatment is not as good as it would be if you were off of it. It's basically that type of a choice. And I tried to understand, because it's so hard, to understand it, but it's still hard. So in other words, the caregiver is wrestling with the idea of, from my perspective, they're still alive as long as they're on that machine. You know, I know that intellectually I'm supposed to accept the fact that that machine isn't going to make them better and that their quality of life may not be that great, but they're still alive. And they've been still alive through all these other crises. So we're really dealing with very intense existential life and death decisions. We're dealing with a low education, low resource, substance abusing population. And what are we seeing here? We're seeing the types of intellectual, moralistic, intense values that really would promote some very deep thought and deep dialogues. Then we have the situations where the caregiver knows that something may in the future is going to have to happen. They may be called on to make a decision. They want to be respectful, and they're hitting resistance with the person who is dying. Every time we try to discuss that, she doesn't want to talk about it. She changes the subject. She just wants to talk about living, nothing about dying. We know that dying individuals, frequently the last thing they want to do is give up hope, or they want to live for the moment. So having life and death discussions and saying, when am I going to give up and talk about that, is in a sense kind of forcing them to reduce their immediate quality of life. But from the caregiver's perspective, it's leaving them in a very ambiguous situation because they don't know if they're really going to be respecting the wishes of the person. Then the other thing about HIV/AIDS is their non-traditional relationships. So they may not have, from a family perspective, in terms of family of origin, legal family, as a legal spouse, the right to be involved. When families are involved in making decisions. You can legally designate someone as something, but at the same time, that may not be respected by the extended family. So I don't think he wanted me to do it. Maybe he contacted his brother or his mother to do it. He didn't ask me to do it, so certain things he confides in me to do and certain things he don't. So here's where he's the caregiver. This person's the caregiver of the other person. And they still don't feel that they're the one that when it comes down to the final life and death, that they're going to be pulled in, that suddenly a new family member is going to come in and make this decision. So that's what they are facing as the person dies. Post-death, we went back and assessed their functioning. And they definitely are in a state of intense grief and bereavement. It was anywhere from a month to 6 months post-death. 88% of the time thought about the deceased almost all the time. 88% missed him or her almost all the time. They felt anxious and unsettled at least most of the time, and cried or felt like crying at least most of the time. So we're really talking intense grieving. During the past 4 weeks, tried to be irritable, tend to be irritable with people, concentrating on things was difficult, can't avoid thinking about the deceased, awake most of the night, loss of appetite, loss of energy, feeling depressed, anxious, and unsettled. To what extent did the dying experience intensify the response that the caregivers had? They were in the hospital their last month of life, so there was this period of being pulled out of their setting, and they moved to that from the home. Then a member of the care team, this is what we wanted to kind of find out about, did a member of the care team talk to the advise the caregiver in advance what would happen at the time of death, so they were kind of prepared. And 88% said that yes, that did these are all no's. I should have had a little label up there. 88% said that this didn't happen. So they felt that they were unprepared for this, what would happen after death. 75% said no one from the care team called to check on the caregiver post-death. Offered no condolences, did not check on how they were doing. And 50% said that no one from the care team suggested that they might want to talk to someone if they were feeling overwhelmed. In other words, offer mental health supportive services post-death. When we asked what were they satisfied and dissatisfied with around the end of care that the patient was getting in the immediate few days before death, what was very interesting is I pulled up the main areas of dissatisfaction. This is basically the last slide of findings. And even though there are a number of things here in which they talked about what they were dissatisfied with regarding the patient, the things that dissatisfied them more was the lack of what they felt they needed. So they training received to provide care at the end of life, support and assistance post-death, availability of nurses to the family. They were more bothered by the lack of support to themselves, even though it was still high up on their list of the feeling the doctors should be more available to the patient, felt that the patient's symptoms were not as controlled at the end of life as they should have been, so really should have been palliated, and also the speed with which the symptoms were treated. So even though those are very high numbers, it was even higher the sense to which they themselves felt that their needs were being neglected, and their needs, in a sense, related to their relationship as a caregiver. So what is this? What are the implications from our perspective? When we're talking about patient-centered care, definitely in situations like palliative care, we really need to expand on it and talk more about a family-centered care model. Network members not only provide support and practical assistance, are not only relied on as the surrogate decision makers, those are very stressful tasks, so they need support in that particular role as a caregiver. Caregivers provide very essential services in HIV/AIDS. They do it in a lot of palliative care, but definitely HIV in settings where resource poor, not enough services, someone has to advocate, coordinate care, be there for them. So services designed to really address the needs of the HIV caregivers need to be more strongly attended to. And post-death, the accounts document distressing events and interactions with the healthcare team that appeared to have impacted their ability to immediately go through the grieving and bereavement process not as intently. So that kind of illustrates that while we are dealing with a population in the Bronx, we also are dealing with a disease that impacts medically challenged individuals, and that when you bring in a model such as palliative care dealing with this type of thing, that we need to kind of intensify more our attention on it being a family-centered approach.
Which I'm sure you have much more than I have, and these are the same issues regardless of the disease, regardless of the setting, regardless of the caregiver constellation. Here, it's the same issues, only more so.
Yes.
And I think what I take away from your presentation is there is a set of issues that's common to palliative end-of-life care. How do we tailor this commonality?
That's a very good way of summarizing it. I do extensive research in cancer, and very early on in the AIDS epidemic, AIDS followed the way cancer was originally perceived and treated and the reactions that were going on. Then what happened is cancer became a little bit more stabilized and mainstream, but still the issues around grief and bereavement, pre-death intervention, supporting the family members, to reduce complicated grief was there. What happens when you bring in AIDS is the cancer was originally a stigmatized disease early on. It's no longer, in most cases, a stigmatized disease in all settings. It's still, but AIDS still retains that very strongly. It's also, in many cases, a hidden disease. When, depending upon what who the extended family is involved in providing care, they still may not be admitting to the fact that the person that you're caring for is dying from AIDS. Because of fears of infection, being shunned, not being allowed, children are still having problems going to school in some settings. It really, so that the takeaway message of turning it up a notch and looking at the unique elements, building on the commonalities that are present whenever we're dealing with any type of chronic disease that ultimately leads to death, and when family members are heavily involved is really true. And then when we bring in a resource-poor environment where traditional, the supportive services that are readily available, I mean, being able to get pain medications, the pharmacies won't necessarily stock them. High-end palliative care specialists, that's not that widely present in these particular types of communities. And you frequently have to attend to all the other supportive services, so the palliative care model for HIV is a model of when we well with some national programs who were providing palliative care to homeless patients, they first had to build houses for them because nursing homes wouldn't accept them. So they provided their own built-in hospice right on the clinic premises to be able to provide the palliative care. Yeah.
Seems like there's a lot of confounding factors here looking at health disparity literature. You mm-hmm. have populations that usually experience health disparities, you mm-hmm. have the impoverished population, and mm-hmm. then you have the stigma of the disease with the gay and lesbian population. So it's like all of these things are on top of the same thing. Are you going to publish this in like a health disparities journal or something like that? Because I think it fits right into that health disparities and health equity issue.
We've published a number of different articles that I think with the increasing emphasis now of highlighting health disparities, we really should make our next publications focus on that particular approach. And I welcome your suggestion because what it does is it pulls me back to saying yes, this is where we need to kind of go next.
Also, Minority Health has a couple of initiatives going on. They have the HIV strategy.